morning, Chief Justice Steele, members of the court. I'm going to please the court. For the record, my name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm representing the appellant, in this case, Lou Price. There's really just one issue in this case, and that issue is whether what is the court going to do about an admitted case of prosecution misconduct. Here we have a situation where very shortly before closing arguments began, the state made an application for an instruction on accomplice liability. And the trial court said no. And the closing argument, at least in part, focused directly on the argument that Price was an accomplice to Daniels, who shot the victim several times.
Well, before we get into the substance, I'm intrigued by your comment that this is an admitted case. I may have misread the record, but I got the impression that the trial prosecutor acquiesced in a curative instruction, but never really admitted that she had done anything inappropriate. And I was also struck in the record by what I thought was a gratuitous comment by the trial judge, that I know you only did it inadvertently, or I know you didn't do it intentionally. I'm having some real difficulty understanding how
one gets
that from the context.
We're not claiming that this was an intentional violation of the court's denial of the accomplice liability theory.
How could it be anything but intentional?
I'm sorry?
How could it be anything but intentional?
Well,
she didn't know what she was saying?
Well, I think it was, my guess is probably that the prosecutor had her closing argument written out, thinking they were going to get accomplice liability instruction, and just kept rolling. When I say intentional, I mean in almost a criminal sense. I think it was inadvertent, but it was also inexcusable.
There's a real problem with your saying that both of those statements in the same sentence, because if it was inadvertent, then it's much more readily excusable. And I don't understand how anybody could say that this was inadvertent.
Well, maybe I'm giving the state the benefit of the doubt here. You could certainly say it was intentional, and certainly the prosecution should have thought about this and obviously didn't.
Yeah, do you mean inadvertent? Did you and the trial judge mean inadvertent in the sense that clearly the words were intentionally uttered? Clearly they have implications that they were an argument that had been flatly rejected by the court, and anyone awake at the time of the ruling would know they were barred from making such an argument, but it just slipped out anyway?
I'm giving the state the benefit of the doubt. You can't get into somebody's head and figure out what was going through their mind when they said that.
No, but I guess where I'm coming from and what I would like some discussion about is that you look at what is said in the heat of questioning or a closing argument or whatever it may be, and you see how much time is devoted to the point and how it comes out. And arguably, from those factors, you can draw a conclusion that, oh, well, this person just kind of went one step too far in discussing a particular issue. And you can see where the person really wasn't thinking about the fact that, uh-oh, I crossed the line here. With the transcript that we have, how are we supposed to draw that kind of a conclusion?
Well, I don't think you can. This wasn't something that was kind of, you know, heat of the moment kind of thing. It wasn't. That's true, I would agree with that. And I guess maybe I was being overly conservative in my brief. That's probably my fault. I don't read Hunter as requiring some kind of bad motive, if you will, to invoke Hunter. And I guess I'm, like I said, I'm being conservative here, but I would agree with Your Honor, Justice Berger, that it would be very difficult to conclude that this was anything but an intentional comment.
Okay,
based
now,
on the record.
And now that I've drawn you in that direction, the flip side, which of course is a concern to everyone, is if we assume it was wrong and it was intentional and so on and so forth, does it make sense that the result is that your client gets to walk?
Well, I guess the result is my client gets a new trial. He doesn't get acquitted. The state can certainly try him again, unless this court for some reason says it can, and I don't have any authority. This court has reversed convictions for prosecutorial misconduct many, many times in the past. And the
well,
result
not
is,
that many times.
Well, I think the last murder case was probably Hughes, but many times, at least in Hunter, they said, at least, I think the court's phrase was 5 or 6 times. But it's not, it's an unusual occurrence, but not an unheard of occurrence. And the remedy is a new trial. Now, I suppose the state is going to argue, look, this wasn't really a close case. We had 2 eyewitnesses who saw Price shoot the victim. We had DNA evidence on a cigarette butt.
And do you dispute
we had this
that?
Phony alibi.
Right.
So you know, this wasn't a close case.
Would you agree that it wasn't a close
and
case?
And I agree it wasn't a close case.
Okay.
But then you get back to Hunter. And Hunter wasn't a close case either. And in Hunter, they said, we're not just going to fall back on the Hughes factor, the closeness of the case, the ameliorative, that's a bad word, effect of the curative instruction. We're going to add another factor. And that factor that the court added in Hunter was, is this something that we've told the state on prior occasions not to do, and they're still doing it?
There's an interesting irony, I think. I can't recall a case where a prosecutor has been told you will not get an instruction on that issue, and yet the prosecutor argues the issue in summation. So there is no, and thankfully there is no, track record of a prosecutor doing that in the past. The absence of you haven't been told not to do it before has what effect in a situation like this in a Hunter analysis?
Well, I think Hunter applies because it's the type of thing that, and here the prosecutor knew where the line was, no question, and crossed the line. And the point in Hunter was, we've told you where the line is, you keep crossing it, and we're going to, at some point, we have to say enough's enough and reverse a conviction, irrespective of the closeness of the case. So I think this is a Hunter case because the state knew where the line was very clearly, and they very clearly crossed the line. And I think that's why Hunter applies here.
But you would more or less concede that it didn't make any difference in the outcome of your client's conviction.
Well, it could have.
You concede it was not a close case.
Well, it wasn't a close case, but nevertheless, the jury could have accepted Price's alibi defense. They could have. And said he wasn't there, concluded he wasn't there, and he didn't participate, and could have found him guilty based on accomplice liability, even though the court told him not to do that.
Is the comment made by the prosecutor that's objectionable, is it really directly related to the instruction that was asked for?
Yes.
And because I read it more as not quite accomplice liability, but rather Mr. Price was directing your client's activities.
Well, that's what accomplice liability is.
Well, is it? Or isn't it just two people who go in together to do something and they're responsible for what the other does?
Well, under the law of accomplice liability, the accomplice is not necessarily the person who commits the actual crime. In other words...
So does there have to be direction involved in order to get accomplice liability?
Direction can result in accomplice liability. If I'm standing next to somebody...
Are there two... I'm exposing ignorance here. Are there two instructions that are similar. One would be, you're the boss, you weren't even there, but you instructed it to happen, and therefore you're liable.
That's accomplice liability. In other words, to give you an example, I call you up and say, hey, you want to go out and have a few drinks tonight? And you say, sure, I'll meet you at 8 o'clock. I call up my friend and I say, Mr. X isn't going to be home at 8 o'clock. I know he's got a lot of money hidden in the basement. Why don't you break into his house and get it and split it? I'm an accomplice, even though I never set foot in his house, never take the money, and maybe never even get anything.
But this was a little different. Your client was, there was evidence, and I know Judge Tolliver said in his remarks that he didn't think there was substantial evidence, but there was some evidence that your client was actually the boss or the employer of the other actor.
Well, he certainly was the boss of the drug dealing operation. And certainly everybody described Daniels as his kind of right-hand man. There's no question about that, but the question is, was Price an accomplice to the shooting? In other words, did he direct somebody else, in this case, and that was State's theory, did he tell Price, either spoken or unspoken, shoot him?
All right, okay, well, thank you, that clears it up.
Now, if he did that, and Judge Tolliver said there really wasn't any evidence, at least enough to support an instruction on that theory, and that's why Judge Tolliver said, I'm not giving an accomplice liability instruction. You can argue he shot him, that Price fired two shots from the Derringer and killed him, and just as an aside, a Derringer, I think everybody knows what a Derringer is.
I thought the medical evidence showed that all of the shots individually were potentially fatal.
Well, that was the opinion of the medical examiner. However, the medical examiner also said that a shot in the toe was fatal. So, there was certainly room for argument that the two shots from the Derringer were not fatal. And the jury certainly could have rejected the medical examiner's argument, especially when the medical examiner testified that a 25 caliber shot in the big toe would have been fatal.
Mr. Bernstein, yes. Tell the court why the curative instruction didn't solve all the problems here. Assuming everything you've said so far is true, one of the differences in this case is that there was an objection and there was an instruction, even though you waited until the closing was over to have it made.
Well, to answer that question, I guess I go back to Hunter. And Hunter basically says that when you add the Hunter factor to the calculus, sometimes the the blameworthiness of the error may outweigh the curative instruction. And here we have what I'm going to say is a virtually unprecedented error.
Well, the only case that's similar to what's characterized as an argument that's not supported by the record was Weddington, where there was race injected into the equation improperly, and there was no basis in fact for it, and notwithstanding an instruction, this court held that when you introduce race into your closing argument without a factual basis, notwithstanding the curative instruction, you get a new trial. But this isn't anything like Weddington, is it?
No. And I think Weddington was probably motivated more by the fact that the error related to race, which is a red flag, or at least in a constitutional sense.
Well, it did, but not only did it relate to race, but it was where race was a central issue in the case, and there was no factual basis for the question, and the prosecutor admitted there was no factual basis for the question.
I recall the facts in Weddington.
Well, here, what we see in Mr. Donovan's brief is that, although with 2020 hindsight, this certainly looked like a statement about accomplice liability. Arguably, you could read it as talking about two principles proximately causing someone's death. you remember him writing that in his brief.
And I think if you go back and look at the language used by the prosecutor in the closing arguments, you will see the words accomplice in there. So it was a very direct reference to, even if you don't think he was there, he's an accomplice. I'm trying to go through my notes here. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm just going to save my remaining time for rebuttal, if that's acceptable to the court.
Appears to be. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Please, court. I'm certainly not going to argue that the prosecutor didn't make a mistake. That's obvious. That's obvious. The trial judge ruled, rightly or wrongly, that an accomplice liability instruction would not be given. However, allow me to point out to the court, in mitigation of the mistake, that a great deal of the state's case was directed towards the relationship between Mr. Price and Mr. Daniels. And indeed, the testimony, I believe, of Mr. Lawrence Butcher, which I quote in my brief, is that the two were like twins. They could look at each other and communicate. So a great deal of the state's case was directed towards that, establishing that intimate relationship. And certainly the fact that when we had two people shooting each other, a third person to death, virtually simultaneously, does lead one to believe that there's a certain amount of complicity here.
Well, but am I right on the record, Mr. Donovan, that the state's testimony was, and there were shots from two different guns, and the shots from either gun could or would have been fatal?
Yes, sir.
So we're really talking about what appears to be the acts of two people that are clearly principals.
Yes, both are shooting the man to death at the same time, which is kind of an odd situation, really. Typical accomplice liability, for example, the robbery of a convenience store. You have one person armed, another person not armed. They both agree, we're going to go in, we're going to commit an armed robbery. One of them shoots and kills the clerk. Well, the other fellow is responsible, too, even though he didn't do the shooting. Now, here we have two people shooting at the same time. Regarding the fatality of the wounds, one of the 25 caliber bullets entered through the abdomen, perforated the bowel, lacerated the liver. A fatal wound. The other one from the Glock, the 45 caliber Glock, entered through the back of the shoulder, went through the lung, and I think also affected the heart. Obviously, also a fatal wound. So either wound would have been fatal, especially since they left the poor fellow on the side of the road, wasn't found for over probably 6 or 7 hours. I mean, he had a long time to die. I agree with my friend Mr. Bernstein that the toe shot was probably not fatal, or would not have been fatal for quite some time. And the fourth shot, which I believe was also from the rear, I believe entered the thigh and fractured the femur, and I'm not a medical doctor. I have no idea whether that would have proved fatal.
Well, your autopsy is interesting, but let's get to the point of the argument here, which is, why would the prosecutor here want to cover the possibility that the jury might not believe that Daniels was a shooter and seek an accomplice charge, know that she was not going to get it, and then make what is arguably the disingenuous argument that, well, I didn't get the accomplice instruction that I think I needed to cover that possibility. So I'll argue that since one was the employer of the other, I will argue to the jury that you can reasonably infer from the evidence that since there was an employer-employee relationship, that Daniels directed Price to do it and therefore was just as responsible. Now, That is the argument that's made to the jury. And that's the problem that the court found, in that it was, in the court's view, just another way of making an accomplice argument. And then when it was put to the judge that if he directed him, then he was responsible, so there's nothing wrong with what I said, the judge says, and I quote, "But there is no evidence that he directed him, not nary a witness that you can point to." Now, under those circumstances, why does this not rise to the level of prosecutorial misconduct that would justify a new trial?
Well, the court has actually asked a number of questions. First of all, the initial request for an accomplice liability instruction, as I said, that the state's case rested in, I think, to a great measure, to establishing an accomplice, a complicity between these two individuals, Daniels and Price, that they acted together. And so I think the request for an accomplice liability instruction was entirely reasonable. In fact, I think there was certainly a rational basis in the evidence for the court to give. May not have been necessary, certainly, either shot.
What is your point then? If the court says there isn't and I'm not giving it, then it's okay for the prosecutor to argue disingenuously a different set of words that ask for the very same thing to the jury? The jury you can find him guilty even if he didn't fire a shot because there's an employer-employee relationship, you should infer that he told them to do it in the absence of any evidence that he did tell him to do it.
Maybe I misunderstood the court's question. I thought the court said it was when the prosecutor asked for an accomplice liability. Your Honor, said the prosecutor asked for an accomplice liability instruction, knowing she would not get one.
No, I
misunderstood.
I'm focused entirely on what the prosecutor did after she knew she didn't have one.
Yes. The court gave what it referred to as a proximate cause instruction, which I quote on page 11 of my brief, which I believe comes very, very close to being an accomplice liability. Now, in arguing the argument that she made, and I am not saying that the prosecutor did not go too far, but I think in light of the court's proximate cause instruction that two people may be responsible for the death of one person, based upon what it said, and also in light of the actually two-day prayer conference and the back and forth among my friends here, and I don't mean to impugn them, but I think everybody got all confused about identifying who's the principal and who's the accomplice, and under Delaware law it doesn't matter. So you just have to show that they're acting in concert. Who directed whom really is immaterial, as long as they're acting in concert. And here, I'm simply saying, there's certainly a rational basis in the evidence for that. But as far as the prosecutor intentionally ignoring the court's ruling that he would not give an accomplice liability instruction, And then going ahead and said, well, heck, I'm going to argue accomplice liability anyhow. I don't care what the court said. I just think that happened. And my very courteous friend, Mr. Bernstein, I think could see that it was not that kind of malicious, I don't care what the court said, I'm going to go ahead and argue this anyhow. I think it was an honest mistake. I think it was simply so, the idea of complicity was so intertwined with this case that it was, quite frankly, difficult to argue the case without arguing that there was some kind of complicity between these two gentlemen who shoot this fellow to death at the same time.
I appreciate that that's what you think, and in light of that, please address this language from the trial judge. And you also said it's Delaware law. And I'm not instructing them in that fashion. You did say it's Delaware law, because that's when I looked up. So how can you say it's Delaware law if I'm not going to instruct them on it?
Yes, and the trial judge was right. You went over into an accomplice liability argument. Now, I'm not saying that...
Do prosecutors understand the implication of a deputy attorney general addressing a jury and telling the jury that this is the Delaware law when they know that the judge will not instruct them in this case that is the Delaware law that applies to this case?
Certainly.
Do they not understand the title deputy attorney general from the Department of Justice conveys to a jury a credibility well beyond that of just an ordinary advocate?
Certainly, sir. Certainly, sir. And I'm not arguing that mistakes were not made here. But I am arguing, and I'm suggesting to the court, that this was a mistake rather than an intentional circumvention of the court's ruling. Obviously, as the court said, I'm not giving an accomplice liability instruction. Then arguing accomplice liability is off limits. This may cramp one's argument. One may have to stay away from certain facts of record. Again, I've argued in my brief there was no misstatement of any facts of record here. This is unlike Weddington, where there was where this race comment, that I think loose white women comment, came out of nowhere. No record basis there. Certainly there was a record basis for everything the prosecutor argued. The problem was that the court had declared that it was not going to give an accomplice liability instruction, and therefore certain facts or inferences to be drawn from certain facts were therefore off limits, and the prosecutor went and argued those facts anyway. I think it was an honest mistake. And again, with the final prong, what is it?
Well, are you saying that the exchange that the Chief Justice read, the trial judge was wrong when he said there's no evidence that this was a directed killing? Because if you look at Mr. Bernstein's brief on page 13, right after talking about the killing being directed, that's when the prosecutor says, therefore, the defendant is responsible for all of the injuries that Kenny suffered from the shots that Jamel Daniels fired.
Well, that's the accomplice liability. It doesn't matter who directed whom. I mean, maybe they just both agreed. I mean, it's not necessary now since their employer-employee relationship.
But it does matter if you're worried as a prosecutor about whether the jury will believe that an individual fired the shots. So you urge the court to give an accomplice liability charge that will make the person who didn't fire the shots responsible as the person who did. And the judge tells you, no, you will not get that charge. And then you nevertheless intentionally argue to the jury that whether Price fired the shots or not, if he directed Daniels to do it, he's just as responsible. We're just supposed to pass that off as just another inadvertent mistake by an unaccomplished prosecutor who in the heat of the moment didn't understand that what she was doing was a direct circumvention of the judge's charge known to her, and in fact compounded that there was, in the judge's view, not a single witness who supplied any evidence to support that comment. Just because this wasn't a close case otherwise, we just shouldn't be bothered by it?
Well, were there some factual issue about whether Price fired or not? Yes, I would say this is a real problem. But here there was no issue. They were both shooters, and they both fired fatal shots. If this were the more typical accomplice case in which we have one shooter and then one accomplice in the underlying crime, say robbery.
Now, the operative word here is directed. That's what the trial judge said. There was no record support that anyone directed anyone else to shoot.
That's, yes, that was argued in the prayer conference. Who was the, again, going back to trying to identify who the principal is and who the accomplice is. And again, as I note under Delaware law, it makes no difference who directs whom.
But my question is, did any witness in this, it's the same question I asked earlier, was the trial judge wrong when he said there was no evidence that anyone directed anyone else to shoot? Is there a witness that testified about someone directing someone else to shoot here?
Not verbally, by any means. Not, no, no one said that Price told Daniels that to help me out. Or
well, that was the point the Chief Justice was trying to make in the question. When you have an argument that says someone, it says here, was directed by the defendant, that's the argument that precedes the legal discussion about accomplice liability.
Right, and I think there was a reasonable, right, despite the fact that there was no witness who said that Price told Daniels, that you could reasonably infer from the evidence and the relationship that Price was the boss, Daniels was the right-hand man, the debt was owed to Price. Price was the one who was angry at Kenny, the victim. Price is the one who wanted to collect the debt. This is Price's drug ring. Price is the one who wants to send the message out to other mules, other dealers. You don't pay me, this is what happens. It's in the old gangster movies. That it's a reasonable inference to draw from the evidence that Price directed Griffith to help him out in the murder of Kenny Griffin. So yes, I mean, I disagree with the court's refusal to give an accomplice liability instruction, but once the court makes the ruling, that's the court's ruling, and that's what you live by. And so all I'm saying is that prosecutor did not mistake the evidence. My point is that the mistake the prosecutor made was in arguing that the evidence and, as the Chief Justice pointed out, Delaware law, that is the law of accomplice liability, which the judge declared by refusing to give an accomplice liability instruction, to be off bounds, that argument, based on facts of record and reasonable inferences to be drawn from those facts of record,
On A97 of the appendix, the court says, in response to the kind of argument you're making about reasonable inferences that there was a direction simply from the employer-employee relationship, the court says, what's most troublesome was, and quotes the prosecutor as saying, that Jamel Daniels knew what was going to happen and was directed by the defendant to help him kill Kenny because of the debt. Now, not surprisingly, the trial judge was troubled by the fact that a prosecutor would make that statement to a jury when there was absolutely no record support. There's nothing in that statement that says you could reasonably infer from the mere existence of an employer-employee relationship that when an employee kills somebody, that they would have been ordered to do so by their employer, a sort of comment that would shock Mr. Bumble from Charles Dickens, no doubt. But here she directly says the evidence establishes that Daniels knew what was going to happen and was directed by the defendant. Now, is there or isn't there evidentiary support that there was direction by the defendant to Daniels to shoot the person?
I yes, sir. I think there's a inferentially rational basis in the evidence for that statement. The very fact that Daniels used the defendant's clock, which other witnesses said the defendant carried at all times, tucked into his pants. What was Daniels doing with the defendant's weapon? There does seem to be, they drove for, 40, 45 minutes together to Adams Dam Road. There certainly is, I think, evidentiary support for the, in addition to simply the employer-employee relationship, that the direction came from Price. And again, I'm not saying that the argument was, I'm saying the argument was incorrect because it was a trespass over the court's, the line the court had established by deciding not to give an accomplice liability instruction. However, I do not concede that, and I argue strenuously, I hope, that there was evidentiary support, that there was no misstatement of the record, that there was a rational basis in the evidence for the jury to infer that Price had directed Daniels to help him out.
Mr. Donovan, if, yes. If you urge the court not to reverse as a remedy for this misconduct, what remedy should the court look at for this sort of continuing prosecutorial misconduct?
Well, this sir is sort of sui generis. As this court has pointed out, and as I think, this court has given a list of the types of repetitive kinds of prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument, and this simply doesn't fit into any of those categories. It's not repetitive. And as far as prejudice to the defense got from the trial judge, there was no contemporaneous objection, but as soon as my friend Mr. Bernstein is too courteous to do that, when the prosecutor finished her opening summation, the judge immediately gave a very thorough curative instruction, and the jury was given a non-accomplice liability instruction. In other words, I think the defendant made out better than he would have had the jury simply been given no instruction at all regarding accomplice liability. The jury was simply told, no, you will consider the actions of Price separate and apart from those of Daniels. And so I think that the defendant made out better in the end. So I don't think the defendant is able to show any prejudice.
Well, Hunter wasn't about prejudice to the defendant. It was about prejudice to the administration of justice, wasn't it?
Yes, sir. Yeah, yes, sir. And that's why I say this is not the kind of repetitive misconduct that this court talked about in Hunter. This is sui generis. I think it was an honest mistake. I urge the court to consider that in reaching its decision. This is not something that's happened in the past. As far as I know, there was no misstatement of the evidence. And I simply urge the court to look upon it as an honest mistake. There are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I'm probably not going to use up all my time, but I do have a couple of comments. First comment is the last thing that Mr. Donovan talked about repetitive conduct, and you should not invoke Hunter. And I would suggest that when a trial court says you can't do something and you do it, that is the type of thing that this court in effect said to Hunter, we've told you in the past you can't do this, but you keep doing it. So we're going to go one step further, which the court did in Hunter, and say, if you keep doing things that we tell you not to do, we're going to add this Hunter factor. And I think there's a very direct analogy here, except it maybe wasn't the Supreme Court saying, don't do this. Here was a trial court saying, you can't argue accomplice liability.
And I think in that sense, it certainly was the type of conduct where there had been certainly fair warning and a transgression. And the second point I want to make is about the strength of the state's case. And what strikes me as being quite ironic is that it's almost like the state can make the argument, well, we had a really strong case here, so it really doesn't matter what we do. You know, we can do anything. And because we have such a strong case, it's always not going to matter. And what this court said in Hunter was, no, you're wrong. Sometimes, even though the case is not a close case, in the interests of the administration of justice, we're going to put our foot down. And we're going to say, enough's enough. And I think, and as I said, I don't think this is a sui generis type of situation. I think it was a serious transgression. And I suppose the question the court has to decide is whether or not we're going to invoke Hunter and whether or not we're going to put our foot down. And even though you could certainly argue that this was harmless error because of the strength of the state's case, because of the jury instruction, the court's going to say the interests of justice simply outweigh those considerations. That's what the court said in Hunter, essentially. We're going to just say no. And that's what we're asking the court to do here, is just say no. You're not going to get away with that, even though you had a strong case, even though the court gave a curative instruction. So we're asking this court to reverse the conviction, order a new trial. Thank you very much. Unless the court has any other questions, although the red light's not on, I'm going to sit down.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under advisement.